both as a force for good and evil, in a way that nationalism was hammered into the minds of these young poor orphans in Werner's life, and the way radio is used in Marie's life, both to literally liberate her in a lot of ways, but also figuratively to teach her about the world. And for Werner, when he hears the Frenchman on the radio as a young boy talking about science, it was a way to open a window of possibility for him that he didn't have. But of course, the novel's about all kinds of different things. It's about people trying to be good to each other under extremely difficult circumstances, and it's about a fabled diamond that's carried out of the Natural History Museum in Paris in 1940, and it's about the cruelty of the Eastern Front, and it's about brainwashing little boys to do a nation's deeds, and it's about love and family and heartbreak and snails and radio.
You mentioned science, and science plays a big part in this. Even the title is, at least on one level, a reference to the electromagnetic spectrum, of which visible light only makes a small part of that, radio waves another part. Why was science important to you and woven so much into this story?
Science has always been a big part of my life because my mom was a science teacher. And growing up, we learned the Latin binomial names for the creatures we'd find outside. And when I would collect shells on vacations in Florida, she would give me guidebooks and help me understand the lives of those creatures that I was finding. So I've always thought that science and literature are not necessarily such separate pursuits. I feel like it's almost artificial to have different buildings on campus, one for science and one for literature. In a lot of ways, they're both ways of asking questions about why we're here, and I've always been interested in those questions. And you know, I couldn't choose a major in college. I really wanted to take the sciences, and I really wanted to study English and history too. And in a lot of ways, I became a novelist so that I didn't have to make that choice. I can still pursue whatever I'm curious about. Yeah, and in the novel, there's so much science in the novel. And you're right, I'm thrilled. It takes a radio person to see that in the title. But yeah, of course, there's a blind protagonist in the novel. But really, the title, the original germ of the title came from me thinking about all the invisible light around us carrying messages between humans, from text messages to cell phones to radio broadcasts like this one.
I was struck by what I thought of in the book as a reverence for objects, a delight in the tactile experience of a seashell or a stone or a key. And I think I've seen that in some of your other work, but not to this extent. Was that because one of your main characters is blind?
It's a really nice observation, Adam. I think so. I spent a long time in Marie's head writing this novel. She goes blind at the age of 6. Her father does all kinds of little exercises with her, both in the Natural History Museum and in Paris, to help her find her way around, to help her identify things. He's always giving her keys or snails or feathers or light bulbs and having her identify them with her fingers. So there would be times that I'd be so involved in the writing of the book that I would forget as soon as I stopped that I could see for a few minutes, you know. And often I would have objects on my desk and be, you know, palpating them in some way with my fingers and trying to understand, you know, in terms of their texture or what they were like and how I could render those in language. So yeah, there is a reverence for objects, no question. Some of those decisions are unconscious when you're writing, and some of them you're just trying so hard to achieve verisimilitude. You're trying to persuade a reader that this is real. And I think for a girl who's so perceptive and so astute, just because she can't see doesn't mean that she can't experience the world in a really full and colorful way.
Tell me more about putting yourself in the head of a blind character.
I tried all kinds of things. You know, I would run my fingers over Braille books. Seashells and snails are really important to Marie and become extremely important as the occupation of France wears on to her. So I would have a lot of shells or pebbles on the desk and feel them over and over again. And of course, at the heart of the narrative is this diamond that may or may not be cursed and may or may not be real. There are 4 replicas of the diamond, and it's not entirely clear if Marie's father has one of them. So I often had a little stone on the desk and would feel it and flip it around in my fingers and try to imagine what her life was like. You know, a lot of my writing is very visual and a lot of my descriptions are visual based. So I wanted to challenge myself and see if I could rely on the other senses to convey a world. But that said, it was often a relief to go to Werner's sections, whose narrative is braided with Marie's, and have a character who could see and use visual details for his version of the story.
There's some really good advanced reviews out now, and I think the one that caught my attention talked about the inherent goodness of your main characters. It seems to me that it's common now in fiction or film or TV to focus on amoral or immoral characters. Why are you looking at people who are deep down truly good?
I'm very interested against this backdrop that we've all seen, which is World War II, in telling a story that folks maybe haven't seen before. I was terrified that I would tell a story which was easily classifiable, a Holocaust story, or a story in which, you know, the Allies are unassailable heroes and the Germans are, you know, death's head skulls sticking their heads up out of tank hatches, scrolling past concentration camps. I wanted to tell a more complicated, less comic booky version of the war. And one way for me to do that against this backdrop of darkness, really, was to try to have these two candle flames of these characters burning. And I think it's always interesting to offset light and dark, and I play with that a lot in the book. I hope that even Werner, who makes some morally complicated decisions and makes some very poor decisions, I hope his decisions are still something a reader can empathize with. You know, he's stuck in the Hitler Youth and then later in the army, the Wehrmacht, and he's got to make very complicated decisions. And I hope even as he's making the wrong ones, the reader can see eventually maybe he'll start to make the right ones.
He's not always the courageous hero going against the flow. He has a friend who decides not to do what everybody else in this German military school does, and it ends very badly for him for making those choices. Werner, your main character, doesn't take as courageous a stand as his friend does. Why is Werner your character and not this other boy who is courageous and heroic?
Great question. Yes. And when he goes to this, it's called Annapolis School. It's a paramilitary school for the elite, really, of the Nazi party. And these boys are taught to do some pretty awful things, along with being taught, good science and being taught poetry by Goethe. And at the same time, they're taught these awful racist classes and, ranking the size of noses and all this phrenology and awful things. But yes, when Werner gets there, he meets a boy named Frederick who is a sweet, pure soul. He loves birds. He doesn't quite pay attention in class. His shoes are always untied. And he ends up paying a very, very dear price for his purity, in a sense, for his dreaminess. I think Werner is my main character because he is probably the most like me. He's in. He has his gifts that set him apart a little bit. He's very good with radio, but he's also not necessarily strong enough morally to always be making the right choice. You know, I'm very interested in the environment, but I drive a truck that burns a lot of gasoline. I fly on airplanes all the time. I still use plastic. I still wear clothes that were made in Asia. I am not always doing the right thing. And early in the book, Werner's sister Jutta asks him, is it okay to do something just because everybody else is doing it? And of course, the answer is no. I have a kind of different kind of guilt in my own life. And Werner, he doesn't make always the right decisions. At the end of the book, he might make a few that redeem him. But he gets wrapped up, and he is not the all-out hero. He does not stand up for the Jews in his community who are being persecuted. He does not stand up for the boys at his school that are being persecuted. And later, when he's in the army, he doesn't stand up for people who may be on the more morally correct side when he's trying to find their illegal radio transmissions.
You set all the light we cannot see in World War II and the years leading up to it, primarily. That's probably one of the most written about periods in human history. Why did you want to go there?
Great question. I didn't for a long time. I was very afraid. Supposedly, if you drop all the books written about World War II on Germany, it'll cover it to like a depth of 2 feet. You know, there's so much out there. And I knew immediately I could never tell a Holocaust story as well as a survivor. And I could never tell a war story as well as a soldier who had lived through it. For me, I ended up sticking with it because of the siege of Saint-Malo, the town where most of the book is set. I felt like that hadn't been told, at least not in English. It's a really interesting moment when the Germans are all buried in like ticks for 7 days. The Allies have no idea how many Germans are there. This is the first time napalm was used, heavy bombardment and artillery assault on the city. And I wondered, you know, what does a child feel through all of this? You know, what does it feel like, especially to be a blind child to undergo all of this? You know, how does that feel? What does it sound like? And then, you know, second, I wanted to conjure up that time when radio was the preeminent technology, you know, the way the internet is now, the way television was after the war. You know, here was a time I knew I had to go back to, a time when to hear the voice of a stranger in your house was a powerful thing. And so those are really the reasons I went back to that time. I feel like now is this amazing time for World War II when people for whom the war is memory are dying in droves, really, and that the war is becoming something that politicians use, that the History Channel uses, and often they're telling very black and white stories about good versus evil, Allies versus the Axis. It almost becomes a video game, and in some retellings. And so I wanted to try to say to the reader, you know, this for these two children, this war was a lot more complicated maybe than we think it was.
Is the power of hearing the voice of a stranger in your living room, is that why you chose to have a blind character, or was it that you had a blind character and that the voice in the darkness was something particularly powerful for her?
In early iterations of the story, I had a boy trapped in a cellar listening to a girl read him a story over the radio. He's in darkness and he can't, the only salvation he has is the story coming over. And that really was the story for a year. I didn't know when it was set. I did not know the circumstances of his entrapment. I just knew that I didn't even know what she was reading to him yet. It turns out to be Jules Verne in the novel. At that point, all I knew is that there was something powerful about her voice reaching through walls, through rock, and speaking to him. Because for the history of humanity, that's something that was impossible. And I wanted to get the reader there. And I can't articulate why I felt like she needed to be blind and in a sense trapped in her own locked room of her head, and literally in an attic in the story, and have him trapped in this, you know, impenetrable rock cellar in France. You know, I didn't know the answers to those things until after 8 years of fooling around with them.
So you have been with this story for 8 years?
Yeah, no, really 10. 2004 is when I was riding on a train into New York City, and we went underground into Penn Station. Probably 60 or 70 feet of concrete and steel above us, and a man in front of me lost the connection on his cell phone. He was talking about the Matrix, remember? Matrix Reloaded, actually, the second Matrix. And he lost his call and got kind of physically angry. And I remember thinking, that's not right. He's forgetting, or we all forget all the time, what a miracle it is to carry this little receiver and transmitter in our pocket that can talk to people in Australia or Madagascar or Thailand. And so, that was the original genesis, and that was 10 years ago.
How has it changed and evolved since then?
It was really a matter of bringing it down into focus. I had a girl. I had the boy trapped listening to a radio, but I didn't know who they were. I didn't understand, why the nations who got into World War II got into it. So I had to read a bunch about World War I and the Treaty of Versailles. I had never been to the Natural History Museum in Paris. So often when you're started on a project, it's all these things that start coming into your life. You just try to stay open. I was on book tour in France and got to see the town of Saint-Malo. My editor explained to me that it had been painstakingly rebuilt after an American assault in 1944. So I thought, that's incredible. You know, I never would in 100 years understand that all these buildings were rebuilt. All these medieval walls had been really carefully reassembled. Then I go to Paris. I get to go to the museum. I start thinking about, you know, what happened to all this wealth, all these fossils, all these jewels, all this gold? What happened to all this stuff when the Germans came in 1940? And then I learn about the key system and this key pound where all the keys to the museum were kept. And I wondered, you know, who might be in charge of that? Who would know all the locks in this huge museum complex? And so that's why I invent Marie's father, the locksmith. And so, you know, month after month, year after year, it becomes this accretion of experiences mixed with imagination. And then you start dreaming out this thing you're making. You know, it never comes to me fully formed.
When they rebuilt Saint-Malo, did they have a detailed scale model to work with?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I know they looked at old blueprints and that, you know, they actually would number these blocks that had been blown out of the buildings. The blocks had to be fitted back into the right spaces. Really an incredible effort. Not a big part of the novel, but this effort of almost erasure, you know, this collective erasing of this event by, you know, reassembling these walls is an important psychological thing as well as a physical thing.
Is that would have been really handy if they had somebody who made a detailed model, you know, just before the war started.
Right. I know there is a fascination with models in the book. I'm not sure exactly where that comes from. I had these little Japanese wooden puzzle boxes as a kid. I had two of them, and I loved them. I was amazed by them. I loved giving them to my friends and seeing them struggle to open them. So puzzle boxes and models have just been a thing of mine. So I loved giving the father those skills and having Marie play with them and learn about them.
So what are you working on now? What are you going to come back here in 4 years and talk about?
Well, I probably won't come back in 4 years. Right now I'm writing a piece about the Panama Canal. The Mint Museum in North Carolina invited me to write a piece to go along with an exhibit they're doing in the fall to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the completion of the Panama Canal. So I'm writing about a 20,000-word piece of fiction about the eradication of yellow fever in Cuba and then Panama, and how it's so interesting to me, like how we didn't understand mosquitoes were transmitting the disease, and it took these great acts of courage to even convince people that mosquitoes were the reason that yellow fever was being transmitted. You know, it's this scourge of humanity, and really this one man, along with Dr. Walter Reed, whose name is familiar to a lot of Americans, this man named Gorgas, who later became Surgeon General, through a lot of courageous acts, eventually kind of erased yellow fever from much of North America. So,
and when will that come out?
That exhibit's in the fall. I don't know what else I'll do with the piece. It's not quite long enough to put it in its own book, but I don't know. I'll have to figure out what else I can do with it. They'll make a little booklet of it for the exhibit.
Any short story collections coming up you could put it in?
Yeah, maybe. I've been thinking about that. Right now I'm going to see this new novel out and go on my 3-week book tour, and then I'll have the summer to start dreaming up new stuff.